content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. And we begin today with Why You Might Need an Adventure by Arthur C. Brooks. Almost everyone knows the first line of Herman Melville's 1851 masterpiece, Moby Dick. Call me Ishmael. Fewer people may remember what comes next, which might be just some of the best advice ever given to chase away a bit of depression. Whenever I find myself growing grim about the month, whenever it is a damp, drizzly November in my soul, whenever I find myself involuntarily pausing before coffin warehouses and bringing up the rear of every funeral I meet, then I account it high time to get to sea as soon as I can. Melville's narrator was ostensibly a 19th-century whaler whose cure for what he called the hypos was to hit the high seas and forget his troubles. Whaling was not exactly curling up with a cup of hot chocolate and a comfort dog. It was brutal, exhausting, dangerous job. So Ishmael's prescription might seem counterintuitive to advice in today's era of self-care, but Melville perhaps knew something that we have forgotten. When life is getting you down, the answer is not more comfort, but less. If you're troubled by your own case of the hypos, the remedy might be a tough challenge. In 2017, a scholar at the Murdoch University in Australia proposed a provocative hypothesis about why materially comfortable humans would nonetheless be drawn to difficult, even dangerous, tasks. The researchers started from the observation that the universe is at once life-giving and deadly, and that therefore, from the onset, humans need to embrace risk to flourish. This characteristic, arguably encoded in the genome ever since, may manifest in human beings as a tendency to adopt risky, heroic behaviors and admire them in fellow human beings. That genetic inheritance gets reinforced by culture, which is why heroic adventure forms the basis of nearly all mythologies. This was Joseph Campbell's famous conclusion in his 1949 study of archetypes, The Hero with a Thousand Faces. In it, Campbell, who was a professor of literature, laid out the structure of the monomyth, which provides the underlying architecture of a narrative tradition that spans millennia, commonly known as the hero's journey, such as the Old Testament's King David story and George Lucas's Star Wars series. This myth opens to a call to adventure, proceeds through a series of difficult trials and dangerous obstacles, and finally ends in triumph. The psychoanalyst Carl Jung, who, among other things, popularized the concept of archetypes, saw that for anyone pursuing some metaphysical form of the hero's journey might be indispensable to finding satisfaction in life. Only one who has risked the fight with the dragon and is not overcome by it wins the hoard, he wrote. Evidence from modern researchers does indeed suggest that framing one's life as this type of quest, even when it is difficult or unwelcome, can lead to positive transformation. In one 2023 experiment, scholars asked participants to reframe their life as one that followed the steps in the hero's journey. The researchers found that doing so raised their subject's sense of purpose. It also made a difficult task more meaningful to them and improved their resiliency to trouble. But beyond simply rewriting your life story to be more of a hero's journey, starting an actual one in the form of a volunteer challenge or adventure can bring immediate and big happiness benefits. Consider a 2013 study finding that experienced climbers tend to derive unusual spiritual inspiration, experience a greater sense of flow, and generally feel happier when they climb mountains. A 2023 meta-analysis of research on outdoor adventures showed that participants in these experiences profited in at least one of four ways: physical and mental balance, personal development, community, and immersion and transformation. A challenging adventure doesn't have to be physical in nature to bestow benefits. It can equally be mental. Indeed, learning new things with a spirit of curiosity and exploration has been shown to induce positive moods. This raises an interesting paradox that appears in this field of happiness research. People derive a lot more happiness from high-skill activities that require learning than they do from low-skill ones that don't. Yet we typically settle for the latter. In other words, you will probably be much happier reading about philosophy or science than you will if you just scroll social media. So why are you still scrolling? The obvious answer is that it takes a lot less learning effort and mental focus. And although the happiness benefits of reading Cicero will probably be greater, they are deferred and seem abstract compared with the instant, if largely illusory, gratification of sitting on the couch watching videos on your phone. Just as more demanding physical and mental adventures raise happiness, their absence can harm well-being. This is a common theme that has emerged from analysis of declining mental health during the coronavirus pandemic lockdowns, when people suffered from a lack of external stimuli and new experiences. Those who did best during this period tended to be people with an adventure-based mindset, who purposely went in search of new, interesting, and challenging things to see and do. If you find yourself a bit grim about the mouth, like Ishmael, you don't necessarily need to risk your life chasing an enraged sperm whale around the world, but you don't have to accommodate your melancholy either. I can suggest two approaches that you can employ right away to take on your hypos. The first strategy is to use that narrative device of the hero's journey to reframe your difficulties. This can be especially powerful if you have recently endured an event or hardship from which you're still struggling to recover. Say, for example, that you went through a bad breakup that you did not initiate. This experience is all too easy to frame as a humiliating defeat or evidence of failure. It is nothing of the sort if you can think of it this way instead, that your breakup jerked you out of a complacent reverie and an unwelcome evidence that you were not actually in the right relationship. That realization is, in fact, your call to adventure, per Campbell. Now confronted with this truth, you can embark on the second stage of your journey, learning to overcome emotional obstacles and getting stronger through your pain. The greatest stage lies ahead, when you will emerge triumphant, more secure, more emotionally intelligent, more self-knowing, ready to love again and be happier on your own terms. The second strategy, if your life simply feels dull and gray, is to go find a challenge that is worthwhile, hard, maybe even scary. If you've gotten a little too comfortable marking time in work that doesn't inspire you, perhaps you should announce your intention to quit and start a job search. If the information you carry in your head has become stale to you, maybe it is time to go back to school in a new field. For a physical challenge, sign up for a half marathon in 6 months' time. Or set out to walk a few hundred miles. If your terrestrial existence is getting tedious, go in search of metaphysical truths. And if it shocks people around you who always took you for someone without a spiritual bone in your body, all the better. There is no guarantee that whatever adventure you choose will turn out the way you hope, of course, and that is the point. If it were safe, it wouldn't be heroic. If it were predictable, it wouldn't be an adventure. Even if your heroic exploits prove to be more uncomfortable or painful than you expected, that too is part of your journey. The object is not to win in a conventional way. It is to wake up and be fully alive. If it's for the first time in a long time, it should be bracing. One last point about the adventure you might seek. A common mistake is not to be Ishmael but Captain Ahab. Ahab, the doomed skipper of Pequod, the whaling ship, whose crew Ishmael joined, was singularly consumed with finding and killing Moby Dick, the great white whale. The days leading up to Ahab's fateful encounter with the great whale were a fever dream singularly focused on the object of his obsession. This makes Melville's story an inverted myth, an anti-hero's journey that began with a plan born of hate and vengefulness that brought travails from which Ahab learned nothing, and that ended tragically in a way that permitted no return. Your adventure should have a goal, it is true, but it is called a hero's journey for a reason. Happiness comes not from the blip that is a moment of victory, but from the long arc of living, learning, and loving. This is the best cure for a damp, drizzly November in your mind. Our second story, The Most Miraculous and Overlooked Type of Milk, by Alan Cushing. The Wegmans in Brooklyn's Navy Yard is, sorry to be so dramatic, paradise on earth. 74,000 square feet of high ceilings and long aisles, stocked with nearly everything a person could conceivably want to eat or drink. The milk options alone include beverages made from soy, almonds, oats, cashews, flaxseed, bananas, pistachios, and hazelnuts, in addition, of course, to the lactational secretions of the American cow, all displayed prominently in well-stocked, brightly lit display cases. One of the world's most consumed, most convenient, and least wasteful types of dairy, in contrast, occupies a space about the size of a beach cooler on the bottom shelf in an unglamorous and highly missable corner of aisle 6. It's shelf-stable milk, a miracle of food science, and a product that Americans just can't learn to love. Shelf-stable milk is, as you might imagine, milk that does not need refrigeration and can thus be stocked on shelves. It gets this way by being blasted to 280 to 302 degrees Fahrenheit for 1 to 5 seconds in a process that is hotter and faster and much more effective at killing bacteria than other types of pasteurization. Then it's poured into special packaging that is sterile and airtight, where it can last for months on end. Shelf-stable milk, also known as ultra-high temperature or UHT milk, does not take up space in the refrigerator before it needs to. It does not need to be packed on ice when thrown into a picnic basket or lunchbox. It does not begin, like a car, to lose value as soon as you drive it off the lot. Andrew Novakovic, a professor emeritus of agriculture economies at Cornell, told me that it is almost immortal. It is safe, convenient, practical, and particularly useful in many urban parts of this country, where refrigerator space is at a premium, as well as the many rural areas where grocery stores are spread out. More meaningfully, it doesn't require participation in the resource-intensive greenhouse gas-spewing system of refrigeration that the industry calls the cold chain. For all of these reasons, shelf-stable milk is wildly popular in many parts of the world. Hilton Deeth, a professor emeritus at the School of Agriculture and Sustainability at the University of Queensland in Australia, told me that in some European countries, a good 90% of commercial milk supply is UHT. In France, to be more precise, 19 out of 20 liters of milk sold is UHT. In Spain, 48 out of 50. The Chinese market is growing quickly, Deeth told me, as is the Central American one. In dairy sections around the globe, the default is rectangular, unrefrigerated, plastic-coated cartons of milk that last for months. But in the United States, a market that is at least theoretically addicted to the convenience, no stranger to processed foods, and more attuned to climate change, shelf-stable milk is unpopular. It is not for lack of trying. In the 1990s, Parmalat, the company that popularized UHT milk in Europe, attempted to introduce its product to the U.S. via a splashy marketing push that involved blanketing the airwaves in 30-second spots. By 1995, after all that effort, shelf-stable milk still accounted for less than 1% of the U.S. milk market. As of 2020, it made 3%, according to the analysis firm Verified Market Research. To understand why, you have to understand just how weird, comparatively speaking, Americans are about milk. U.S. adults drink more milk than their counterparts in Europe and are much finickier about temperature. We're just trained to enjoy super cold things, Amy Bentley, a food studies professor at NYU, told me. Milk fits into that. But Americans are also particularly enthralled by some enduring myths about milk. Here, milk is supposed to be fresh and natural. And for that reason, it also needs to be refrigerated, because it is so fresh that, like beef ribs or chicken cutlets or other animal products, it was recently a little bit alive. The earliest American advertisements for milk from the 1840s emphasized its bucolic origins and uncontaminated contents, using imagery of rolling hills and words such as wholesome, fresh, and unadulterated. These ads directed at city dwellers sold milk as a small escape from urban life, which was chaotic, crowded, and artificial. Milk became one of America's favorite beverages, and more than a century later, modern milk advertising still features rolling hills and words such as fresh. E. Melanie Dupuis, a professor of environmental studies and science at Pace University, wrote a book about this. Its title, taken from an early milk advertisement, is Nature's Perfect Food. She calls the myth-making around dairy the imaginary of milk. The imaginary of milk is that it's coming from the countryside, she told me. It's from a happy cow, and it's bottled quickly with minimal intervention. It's old-fashioned Americana incarnate. It is, as Bentley put it, the epitome of wealth and health and freshness, or as the ads put it, pure. UHT milk, with its initialized name and antiseptic packaging, evokes something else. It's imaginary, Dupuis said, is that it is a manufactured product that's coming from far away. Self-stable milk is an affront to the stories that Americans have been told by the dairy industry and pop culture about what milk should be. Those stories are so powerful that Americans refrigerate all kind of milk-adjacent products unnecessarily. Soy and nut milks are just stable, shelf-stable ingredients blended into water, and as such do not require refrigeration before opening. But they are typically sold in the refrigerated section, often at a cost to manufacturers. To them, the symbolism associated with refrigeration is worth it. When Steve Demos launched the soy milk Silk in the late 1970s, he paid supermarkets more to display it in the refrigerator, a canny marketing decision that some experts credit for the eventual widespread adoption of alternative milks. Milk in a bag, milk in an antiseptic container just doesn't feel right, Bentley told me of American attitudes toward shelf-stable milk. It feels substandard or subpar. And in a rich country with relatively large refrigerators, people can afford to avoid it. Because the U.S. is so wealthy and can devote the resources to a cold chain, we do. We do so at no small cost to the environment. As the writer Nicola Twilley outlines in Frostbite, her recent history of refrigeration, mechanical cooling requires tremendous amounts of power for warehouses. Refrigeration accounts for about 8% of global electricity usage, as well as diesel for trucks. It also requires chemical refrigerants, small amounts of which leak into the air as part of the process. Many of these refrigerants are thousands of times more warming than carbon dioxide, Twilley writes. Environmental scientists call them super greenhouse gases. That Americans do this in the service of natural is bizarre, because natural is a bizarre word to use for the process by which a substance meant for baby cows leaves their mother's bodies at 101.5 degrees and ends up hundreds or thousands of miles away, refrigerated in plastic, to be consumed at 40 degrees by a different species. The milk I bought at Wegmans cost $3.49 and was made by Parmalat, which is still holding on to its tiny U.S. market share. It sat in my pantry for a week or so. Even after all this, I just couldn't bring myself to peel back its silvery seal and take a big swig. But then life's great motivator, desperation, intervened. I ran out of cold milk and forgot to buy more. So we opened the Parmalat. The primary milk drinker in my household, who is 1 year old, declared it yummy. I let it sit another day or two in the fridge before finally trying it myself. I really didn't know what I was expecting, but it tasted like milk. Creamy, slightly sweet, as natural as anything else. Our third story, Making Government Efficient Again, by Robert P. Beschel, Jr. Although the plight of America's 2.2 million federal bureaucrats seldom elicits public sympathy, spare a charitable thought for their future. Not since the congressional elections of 1882 has civil service reform received so much political attention. President-elect Donald Trump and his allies now face a fundamental decision. Will they listen to the loudest and most extreme voices in their party and be agents of chaos and disruption in upending the civil service? Or will they adopt a more measured, incremental approach that would deliver improvements and burnish their managerial credentials? Few would argue that the current federal civil service is perfect. In 2017 and 2018, the National Academy of Public Administration, an independent nonprofit chartered by Congress, issued a two-part white paper describing the government's staffing system as fundamentally broken, with too many rules and too little flexibility. Its authors argued that firing non-performers and attracting new talent can be too difficult. Other observers have bemoaned the bureaucracy for its cost, inefficiency, and unresponsiveness. Change is clearly needed and would, in fact, be welcome in many corners of the federal government. Although distinguished bipartisan commissions may agree on a path forward, Republican and Democratic politicians, buffeted by the interests and passions of their bases, have been unable to come together to address these problems. Under pressure from public sector unions, Democrats have shied away from even modest reforms of their own and have focused instead on resisting GOP proposals, which have centered on removing protections from federal employees. Some on the hard right are working toward deconstruction of the administrative state and total destruction of the deep state. But most Americans, including many moderate Republicans and Democrats, do not share this animus. They value government service and simply want to see them perform better. Efficient and effective institutions are easy to degrade, difficult to build. The United States needs to retain the benefits of technical competence and impartial advice from a meritocratic civil service while ensuring that federal employees are accountable to political oversight. These are the more constructive ways to achieve the objectives that both Republicans and Democrats claim to want, while retaining a high-performing, meritocratic civil service. Late in his first administration, Trump used an executive order to introduce Schedule F, which sought to remove civil service protections from any career official with a policymaking role, giving the White House much greater discretion in hiring and firing. Currently, there are about 4,000 political positions, out of which some 1,200 are subject to congressional approval. The number of positions that could be designated as Schedule F is unknown, but estimates suggest it could be 50,000 or higher. Trump's campaign pledged to immediately reissue my 2020 executive order, restoring the president's authority to remove bureaucrats. And he himself has promised to wield this power very aggressively. He will have broad support from his party, which has sought to reap political benefit from stoking public hostility toward civil servants. In the Senate, Florida's Rick Scott has been the Republican most aggressively pressing for a radical restructuring of the civil service. In 2022, he rolled out his 12-point Rescue America plan, which included a proposal for many government agencies to either move out of Washington or be shut down entirely. Although about 85% of federal employees already work outside the greater Washington, D.C. area, the idea of moving staff out of the Capitol has caught on in Republican circles. Cutting civil service protections is also popular with the MAGA base. The Public Service Reform Act, which Scott introduced last year, proposed to place the entire workforce in at-will employment status, allowing them to be terminated for good cause, bad cause, or no cause at all. And then there is the Heritage Foundation's Project 2025. Tonally, the document is uncompromising. The federal government is a behemoth deployed against American citizens and conservative values. Federal bureaucrats are underworked, overcompensated, and unaccountable. The project argues that the entire edifice of civil service protections is a legacy of the American left. That statement is partly accurate, but woefully incomplete. Republicans have historically been at the forefront of reform efforts. And the last major one during the Carter administration was a notably bipartisan affair. As Francis Fukuyama has argued, the reintroduction of Schedule F will make the federal government less competent and vastly more politicized. The United States already has a much higher number of political appointees than any other advanced industrial democracy, nearly 28 times the number in the United Kingdom, for example. Political appointments stretch down four or five levels of bureaucracy in some agencies, such as the Department of Defense. Republicans would be unwise to view Trump's re-election as a mandate for completely uprooting the civil service. A recent study of public confidence in government by the nonpartisan Partnership for Public Service found disturbing evidence of reduced trust in government. Yet attitudes toward federal employees remain positive. A majority of respondents agreed with the statement that most civil servants are competent. A similar proportion agreed that most are committed to helping people like me. Only a quarter of respondents said that the president should be able to fire any civil servants that they choose for any reason. Several measures could improve responsiveness, accountability, and performance at a much lower cost and risk than the ideas currently circulating. Departments and agencies should have more flexibility in managing their human resources and be empowered to tailor their personnel policies to their particular business needs. The allocation of political appointees across the government needs a regular review. A bipartisan commission should examine the current 4,000 such posts and make recommendations to the administration about streamlining and redistribution. Performance management is a key area for improvement. Currently, less than 0.5% of the federal workforce is rated marginally satisfactory or unsatisfactory, which at best stretches credence and at worst damages public trust. Labor relations in the civil service need an overhaul. The processes and paperwork surrounding termination should be simplified, the window for appeals should be narrowed, and the role of unions in the grievance process for individual employees should be curtailed. Once the new Trump administration is in office, the American people will expect it to deliver the public goods and services they rely upon and do so smoothly, fairly, and efficiently. Disruption may sound trendy in Silicon Valley or tough in conservative think tank circles, but delivery is what will ultimately determine the success or failure of these reforms. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.